Who to trust, what to believe. Misinformation, disinformation, and crazed conspiracies are all around us. President Donald Trump has added a new phrase to the lexicon, fake news. He may mean news is fake only because he doesn't like it, but the label sticks. Maybe it is fake. People can have their lives ruined by online trolls spreading malicious gossip. For example, Brigitte Macron, the French president's wife, is a victim of online trolling alleging she's a man, and people start to believe it. The Macrons are now suing the troller. Every debate, from immigration and asylum seekers to whether Britain is broken, is dogged by the high emotions provoked by online lies. It's generating a crisis of trust that makes social interaction ever harder and is engulfing the process of government. What can be done? Sonda van der Linden is Professor of Social Psychology at the University of Cambridge and Director of the Cambridge Social Decision-Making Lab, and has established himself as one of Britain's and Europe's leading authorities on these questions. He researches the psychology of human judgment and decision-making, and in particular, how distortions and abuse of the social influence and persuasion process work. How exactly do people become influenced? And how psychologically could they gain resistance to false persuasion and manipulation through psychological inoculation? Welcome, Professor Sonda van der Linden, to the We Society.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Wow. I mean, what a minefield this is. But let's just start. You don't use fake news. You like to use a different nomenclature: misinformation, disinformation, propaganda. Why do you steer away from fake news?
Yeah, I think the term fake news has become so politicized, partly because of Trump. And in fact, we did some research on that, and that people tend to use the term fake news to discredit opinions they don't like. But it's also not a very precise term. And so fake news isn't very concrete in terms of what we mean. So I tend to differentiate between misinformation, disinformation, and propaganda, just because those are more tangible and specific terms rather than the sort of all-encapsulating term fake news that can, you know, easily be used to sort of discredit ideas that people don't like.
I'm struck by your view that misinformation doesn't just mislead. Kind of, the more misinformation you hear, the more that builds into an entire belief system that kind of shapes how people can see the world. Just talk us through that. I mean, I had personal experience of this just recently on a panel program on radio, where I was very, very taken aback by the ferocity with which people kind of held what even a year or two ago would have been seen as extreme views, but plainly believed them.
Yeah, so the way that we process information is very much, you know, based on the context in which we hear it. So, you know, it's one thing for people to be duped by a piece of information. I mean, we've all come across some information that turned out to be false, and you know, we revise our beliefs accordingly. But I think more and more people are becoming engulfed in information diets that are quite high in falsity or low in credibility, depending on how you want to view it. And misinformation, the way that it's produced, both mis and disinformation, they try to exploit psychological vulnerability. So, you know, some of the things that make misinformation stick include, you know, high sort of negative emotions, things that make people feel scared, outraged, hatred. So misinformation tends to play into people's emotions. We know that from other research, too, in terms of looking at how misinformation diffuses online. But also, people don't really come to the table with a blank slate. I mean, we all have beliefs, opinions, identities that filter how we think about and process information. So, you know, if people already want to believe something, or if they've already, you know, have strong opinions about a topic, then they're going to filter and interpret information in a way that's congenial to those prior beliefs. And algorithms and echo chambers, which are fragmented information spaces in which we surround ourselves with like-minded people, kind of trick us into the sort of false sense of consensus. And it's, in fact, it's called a false consensus effect, where you start thinking that everyone around you agrees because you surround yourself with like-minded people and opinions. And so that's a very influential social effect, because it gives you the sense of social validation that, you know, your beliefs are the right one. And then so when people leave that echo chamber, they're sometimes surprised that there's people out there who might disagree with them. And so for all of these reasons, you know, the information diets that we have, where you're getting your news from, your prior beliefs, identities, emotions, all of those things affect how we deal with information, and particularly misinformation. But there's also qualities about the brain itself that make people vulnerable. So we know that the more often or the more misinformation is repeated, the more likely people are to believe it. This is called the illusory truth effect, which is a very basic psychological effect you can easily demonstrate in the lab, which is basically that, you know, repeated information is deemed more likely to be true than non-repeated information. And that's because the brain mistakes fluency for accuracy. And so that's the speed with which you can process a unit of information. And that speed goes up the more familiar it feels. And things can feel familiar for lots of reasons, because you've heard it before, because a trusted person in your circle has mentioned it to you a few times. And also it becomes morally sort of less questionable for people over time. So when you start out with an outrageous claim, and this goes back to, you know, Nazi propaganda around this idea of the big lie. So you start out with some, which the Reichsminister for Propaganda, Goebbels, at the time came up with, although there's some debate between him and Hitler. But the idea is actually start outrageous, and then keep repeating it, because, you know, who would fathom that someone would come up with an outrageous lie and just keep saying it? I mean, that's just not what people would do. So it must be true. And so over time, you actually see that effect, that people start to think that sharing that type of misinformation feels less immoral because, you know, people are repeating it. You know, it must be something to it. And so that kind of builds this sort of gist intuition. And that's very important, because the way that we navigate the world is often based on a gist of something, our intuition. And so once misinformation kind of creeps into the background of our sort of psychological mindset of what is likely to be true or not, based on how often you've heard it, based on whether, you know, it emotionally resonates with you, based on your identity, based on your prior beliefs, based on what people around you say, you know, the more it settles in and it distorts our memories. In fact, you can do experiments on that. You know, we did, there's some research during Brexit on that if you tell people something that would be congenial to the side that they're on, whether you were pro or anti-Brexit, people just go on like, oh yeah, I remember that slogan, or, you know, I remember seeing that article, but it never happened because the experimenters made it up. But people just think it's true because it coheres with what they wanted to be true at the time. And so, you know, our brains are susceptible to manipulation in that way.
So much there. And as you've been speaking, I've been thinking about, you know, one obvious kind of big lie of recent past is, which I think has grown exactly the way you described, is, you know, Donald Trump's view that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. I mean, there's no evidence for that, but he said it over and over and over and over. And all the effects you've described kind of play out. Is that an example of what you're describing?
Yeah, that's the perfect example. So, you know, it's hard to think of a claim that is completely unreasonable and outrageous that gets traction through this mechanism of repetition, other than the big lie. I mean, there's a few. There's one about the economy, and often like, oh, the greatest economy. Well, in fact, that wasn't true at all. But certainly the election denial conspiracy theory has surpassed that. You know, just the election was stolen, the result can't be true, and you just keep repeating it. And over time, people start to think it's true. And you see the population level effects too. I mean, people tend to think that, you know, this was a contained militia that sort of stormed the Capitol as part of an insurrection, which of course is you know, bad enough in terms of undermining democracy. But actually, if you look at the polling numbers, I mean, you were talking about 40% of you know, of voters, in this case,
believe it,
conservative voters, yeah, who thought that was true. that the election was stolen. I mean, these are major swaths of the population. And so this is, you know, isn't some small minority. I mean, a small minority will act violently on it, which is another type of problem. But larger segments of the population actually believed it because he kept saying it. Other influential people keep saying it. You know, it leverages other interesting things about conspiracy theories, which is, you know, they're kind of designed in a way that makes it almost impossible to refute them. Because how would you know, just to sort of play devil's advocate, well, just a little bit, like, how would you know that the voting machines were accurate? You know, who's counting them? You know, humans do all sorts of weird things. Maybe somebody stuffed some extra ballots in there. You see how easy it is to sort of create this doubt in people's minds about the integrity of an election. And that's what conspiracy theories and theorists are good at sort of leveraging, you know, the uncertainty that we have in science and engineering and other parts that, you know, is quantifiable to some extent. And we know that there's... Yeah, go ahead.
What's particular about our times, though? I mean, you know, you made this reference to, you know, Nazi Germany and the big lie. So it's not exactly news, this, is it? What's new?
No. I mean, propaganda is as old as, you know, as the start of humanity, of course. And so I do sympathize with the view that we've always had misinformation and propaganda. And so people often ask, what's different? I mean, you know, one way to think of it is like, well, what if Hitler had access to social media? I mean, that's kind of a scary thought in a way. And I think it resonates with people because it gets at three different things. One is the speed at which information travels. Two is the nowadays. Two is the way that technology is shaping human, you know, technology interaction. And three is the way that we can target. And so I think, you know, it's true that, you know, there've always been shady individuals who've been trying to put their spin on the truth. But now we have technology that is able to do that in a way that hasn't really allowed us to appropriately sort of prepare for it. So with the election denial conspiracy, for example, I mean, you know, people read stuff on, you know, that conspiracy was able to spread quickly and efficiently through social media, through cable news. And people were able to act on it swiftly because, you know, if you take an analogy, for example, with the Southport riots, you know, one of the reasons that happened in the UK, of course, last summer, one of the reasons that was so successful is because they used technology to plan targets, right? Telegram, which is a social media platform, if people are not familiar with it, it's both a traditional sort of peer-to-peer social network, but it could also use for private messaging. And it's private, and so people feel that they're able to share details that you might not be able to share on a public sort of social media network. But it was used to plan attacks, to coordinate. You can do that, you know, back in the day, you'd have to gather all the people in a room, you know, in a basement somewhere, and then plan your next target and sort of plan it and coordinate it. Now you can coordinate, you know, thousands of individuals on a Telegram group or a WhatsApp group, right? And so that's a major advantage. But also the sheer speed at which information travels. So when somebody floats a falsehood, you know, hundreds of millions of people can be exposed to it in a matter of seconds. You know, back in the day, in my book, Foolproof, I went through the painstaking exercise of calculating how long it would take for a false message to spread in the Roman Empire. And so, you know, on horse and so, you know, we're talking days, weeks for falsehoods to spread, right? Now we can reach hundreds of millions of people within minutes. And so the prevalence and exposure is just, you know, on a much larger scale. And then the way that people interact with technology is just very different, right? So we have closed WhatsApp groups. So you have information coming to you on WhatsApp from people that you trust. I mean, I get sent misinformation in WhatsApp groups all the time from people that are, you know, either family or friends. And so it's already imbued with a sense of credibility because you've accepted these people into your group. They're not random strangers. If we think about how people interact with each other on social media, right? And in some ways, you can be anonymous. You can say anything you want. There's algorithms that are amplifying your content, that are selectively curating it in a way that is meant to push your buttons, right? So we all have they're trying to optimize for engagement, right? And so what is engaging people? Extremist content, you know, content that is, you know, high on negative emotions, content that really gets people going. And so the algorithms know that. So they try to tailor, right, the type of content that keeps people engaged on the platform, often without people's knowledge. So that's different. That's not the way that information has been curated to us, you know, for most of our evolutionary sort of period on this planet. And that's all happened within the course of, you know, a decade or two, not even.
10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the last point is targeting. Right. So we can now take people's digital footprints, what you click on online, your Google searches, the websites that you visit, and target people with both true and false information based on your unique characteristics. Right. What is likely to shift your views, your opinions? And experiments show they can get people to, you know, buy shampoo, vote in a certain way based on the things that you click on. So that level of targeting didn't really exist before. It was mass communication. You were listening to radio propaganda, and then they'd hope that resonate with you, right? So now that can be delivered, you know, personalized in a way that wasn't possible before. AI can now personalize at even a faster rate. It can crank out thousands of messages, you know, within the split of a few seconds. We also have deepfakes, synthetic agents, which are robots online that you may or may not interact with. It's called AI slop. You know, decent proportions of the internet are filled with inauthentic content.
We'd like to tell you about another podcast from our friends over at The Conversation. They're a not-for-profit news and analysis platform pairing academics with journalists on every story. In their podcast, The Conversation Weekly, host Gemma Ware sits down with an academic expert every week to discuss a topic in the news to understand how we got here. From global politics to the latest scientific breakthroughs or the big dilemmas facing our planet, they talk to experts from all over the world who draw on years of research knowledge to pull out what really matters so that you can understand the context without the spin. New episodes of The Conversation Weekly land every Thursday. Find them wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, in the introduction, I said you had some interesting ideas about how to counter all of this. I mean, first of all, let's worry about, as individuals, what we can do. I mean, we could psychologically inoculate ourselves, partially inoculate ourselves, from the influences of misinformation. When I found that brutal, I found that a bit far-fetched. And I tried to take one of your tests, and I thought, I don't know, I got a lot of the way through, but I wasn't sure whether I was succeeding in inoculating myself. Mm. Go ahead and explain what you mean and how to do it.
Yeah, so the idea behind inoculation is actually, you know, the traditional way that we've thought about misinformation is that you need to debunk it, right? That after you've been exposed, we have to tell people it's not true. But negations are really hard for the brain. So once you've been exposed to something, it seeps into your memory, and your memory is like a social network. So, you know, once you've heard that let's say, vaccines are going to change your DNA, it starts to, you know, seep into all your ideas about vaccinations. And then, you know, when you have questions about one vaccine, you're still going to have questions about other vaccines, and it's all sort of interlinked. And so it's like a game of whack-a-mole. And so when you try to debunk something, you can undo some of those links, but hundreds of them have been created. And we know that people keep using it in their reasoning, even when they acknowledge a fact check. So that's why we've tried to come up with a sort of different way of doing it. And so instead of debunking, we focus on pre-bunking or psychological inoculation. So you can pre-bunk in lots of different
pre-bunking.
Ways.
Pre-bunking.
Yeah, pre-bunking.
That's an interesting word.
Trying to prevent people from encoding misinformation into their brains in the first place. And that's now kind of a new field, and you can do that in different ways. But inoculation is one of the main, most established ways in which you do that, which is actually based on the vaccine analogy, right? So just as we expose the body to a weakened dose of a virus to try to trigger the production of antibodies to help confer resistance against future infection, turns out you can do the same with the brain. So you expose people to a weakened dose of a falsehood or the techniques used to produce falsehoods, and you refute them and deconstruct them in advance so people can build up cognitive immunity. And you can measure those cognitive antibodies as well by how good people are at discerning between manipulative and non-manipulative content, how motivated they are to resist misinformation, by how well they remember it, how well they can calibrate their judgments. And so these psychological antibodies, if you will, are quite concrete too. And there's lots of ways in which you can, you know, preemptively expose people to a falsehood or the general techniques used to produce falsehoods. And we've chosen in our early work to go for more of a simulation, which we call active inoculation, which is a kind of a deep dive, letting people sort of generate their own resistance by giving them a simulation of what it's like to be attacked and manipulated online. And in some of our, and I'm not sure, maybe that's one of the games you were talking about, is that, you know, you can step into the shoes of an online manipulator. And
yeah, that's the one I played.
That's the one, yeah. And then you're not actually spreading fake news, right? It's a weakened dose metaphor. So it's all fictional. So it's controlled. You have several options. So it does feel like people have agency, but obviously it's contained. And it uses a heavy degree of sarcasm to sort of, you know, neutralize it, make sure nobody's actually actually duped by anything. But yeah, you know, you start your own newspaper, you learn about polarizing headlines, about emotional manipulation, about conspiracy theories, about, you know, discrediting by sowing doubt about science and denialism. And so that is... the game's called Bad News. It's free. It's an educational tool. Anyone can use it. And yeah, and then we test people.
I enjoyed it, by the way. I enjoyed it. And now I realize what you were doing, and I think actually when I hear you talk about it, I think maybe I am partially better inoculated as a result of playing that game. Actually, you do see what the manipulators are trying to do and the way they think, and I think I'll spot kind of malicious or deliberately misinforming me. Things on social media I wouldn't otherwise have done. So I recommend it, actually. I recommend it. Now that you've explained it better. No, it's good. It's good. It's a good game.
It's a little bit unsettling in the beginning, especially for...
Yeah, exactly.
For
yeah,
journalists.
Yeah. Thank
and
you.
People who concern themselves with accuracy. Yeah, and so... it has very minimal instruction, and that was sort of done on purpose because the game went viral on the internet. So people who spend a lot of time on the internet, they don't like being instructed. That, you know, it's kind of like the fourth wall sort of thing. They don't want to know. And so actually, I think part of the success we had with the game was that it wasn't branded as Cambridge. It wasn't sort of, you know, here's these elites coming to tell you what to believe. It was just sort of step into the shoes of a manipulator, which people are like, huh, that's different. And so it felt almost a bit like, what are we doing here? And so that's how we started. And then, you know, once we scaled this with official organizations, with the World Health Organizations, the United Nations, we did one with the UK government, you know, we did get some feedback about some more, you know, sort of hand-holding and sort of explicit instruction and you know, telling people, look, here's what's going to happen, and this is useful because you're going to be able to better spot the techniques.
That's right. No. It's and go viral, I'm guessing, which is another of your games. I guess it works on the same basis, does it? How does that work?
It works on the same basis.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was during the pandemic. That's the one we did with the government here and the WHO. And it was shorter. It was meant for social media. It has three techniques, you know, fake experts trying to peddle you fake cures during a pandemic, conspiracy theories about vaccinations and microchips and all of that, and emotional manipulation, you know, scaremongering about vaccinations and all this stuff. And again, it's sort of based on... you know, it's not sort of fact-based in that you know, the myths are always evolving. And so, you know, the people go to school. There's other venues where people learn facts. What we wanted to do was, if you go to what I concern myself with is the history of propaganda. So if you go back to the 1800s, for example, there's this, and I do this in presentations, there's this wonderful painting from anti-vaxxers in the 1800s. Yes, there were anti-vaxxers in the 1800s. This was the so when Edward Jenner, of course, came up with the cowpox vaccine against smallpox, which was the first modern vaccine, the anti-vaxxers would do these paintings where, you know, udders would be sprouting out of people's mouths and ears, and you have these images of like half cow, half human. The whole idea was that if you took the cowpox vaccine, you were going to turn into this weird human cow hybrid. So don't get vaccinated. It was a sort of fear mongering, and what we try to do with the game is show people that, you know, when people tell you that this new vaccine is going to change your DNA, that's actually a 200-year-old trope. It's sort of based on these general techniques. And then we make it ridiculous. You join a WhatsApp group called Not Co-Afraid, the country's run out of toilet paper. Because there was actually sort of a toilet paper incident at the time during the pandemic, because people were panic buying and stuff. And so it's meant to sort of kind of be sarcastic and funny and over the top. But people get the point, right? There's all these lizard people trying to take over, and the kiwi eating kiwis cures the virus. And so there's a lot of the sort of fake stuff. There's one guy on the internet we found who was sort of saying that if you hold a blow dryer close to your nose, it kills the COVID virus.
Duh.
So we got all of that stuff from the internet and then sort of, created a game around it.
And what about the Online Safety Act? What can authority do? What can regulation do? What can law do? I mean, is there any role for that? I mean, there must be, but I mean, how to do it best?
Absolutely. Yeah. As you said, social science is, it's a bit fickle sometimes, right? People need to be boosted. One gameplay isn't going to solve, the problem. We know that the effect wears off over time. It's a modest effect. And so, as any social science intervention, it's helpful, but it's not going to...
Well, inoculation happens, You get your COVID jabs every year. You've got to do your pre-bunking,
You got to keep pre-bunking.
You've got to be, round we go, you do it, then cycles of it, it's got to be once every 6 months. Come on.
You got to keep it going. That's right. Otherwise it wears off. But one of the things that we found was, social media companies were, at the time, they were helping. They were scaling this stuff. They were incorporating it. Same with government. But then, sometimes governments change, social media companies get different incentives, different political pressures. So we actually figured, you can't rely on external actors to keep doing the right thing. So
you're describing the election of Donald Trump and everyone, kind of all the social media companies running for cover and
that's right.
In the name of free speech, aren't you? That's
in
what
the
you're
name
describing.
Of free speech, that's right. So, and it's kind of interesting because inoculation is all about more speech. It's empowering people to have counter speech, to think for themselves, free of manipulation. It's not about taking any content down whatsoever. And so it's a very light touch kind of intervention. And some people even say, as psychologists, obviously we're biased at the individual level, but other social scientists have made us acutely aware of the fact that there's institutional, organizational, bigger fish to fry also than individuals sometimes. And so what we've been trying to do is, so one route has been pressuring regulatory bodies. So we got efforts like pre-bunking written into the Digital Services Act in the EU, which was good because they can then exert the top-down pressure on social media companies to keep doing it. But the other is that we need to hold social media companies accountable as well, not just their responsibility to help educate their users, but also to have the right incentives to share data, to be, they should be able to be audited, transparency about what's going on the platforms. They need to have moderation policies, right? They need to ensure that they're enforcing their own anti-hate speech, anti-misinformation policies. They're just not doing it. They have policies, they're just not enforcing them. So the Online Safety Act has come into force. It's doing some good things but at different levels. It's doing good things to protect children from online harms, whether that's sex trafficking, pornography, these kinds of things. It's not doing so well at actually protecting people from misinformation because that's not really part of the Online Safety Act. Many people don't know this, but yeah, it's only mentioned once or twice because it had difficulty sort of, it's based in existing human rights sort of harms already. They need to amend it to broaden its scope to allow Ofcom, the independent regulator, to actually do something about misinformation. They're trying to do things within their remit, such as they're trying to enforce some of the things that fall within their remit. But I think Parliament needs to empower Ofcom to a much greater level. I gave testimony to the House of Lords a couple of months ago. They have a new report out on media literacy where they said the UK is not prepared. Media literacy is far behind other countries. We need to have a new national educational curriculum, and it's the government's responsibility to do something about that. So they're waiting for a response from the government. But It's not been Starmer's top priority. I'm not sure what the plan is, but what I do think is going on is that he's facing geopolitical pressures that are impeding enforcement at not just in the UK, but at the EU level. So Trump is threatening Starmer and the UK with trade sanctions if they do anything against U.S. social media companies that have to do with perceived as censoring speech. And so the question is, can Ofcom actually enforce? Can the Digital Services Act in the EU actually enforce? Are we as a country willing to take geopolitical threats in order to, are we going to capitulate to Trump's demands of if you want favorable trade terms? I mean, what age are we living in? In some ways, you're having someone launch, you know, unrelated sanctions for fining or holding social media companies accountable that are based in the U.S. I mean, they want their speech to spread. They want what they're doing, dismantling all checks and balances on misinformation, and they want to spread that to other countries. They want to have influence in other countries, and so that's their agenda. I think what we have to decide as a country is: are we going to be bullied and intimidated by that, or are we going to enforce our regulations against hate speech and misinformation and be free from foreign influence and manipulation? And that's something that I'm sure is on Starmer's mind and his advisors in trying to make these trade-offs. But so far, I've not been very confident that that they're going to pursue the enactment and enforcement of the Online Safety Act in the area of mis and disinformation, and to some extent, similar concerns with the EU. And so, what I've been trying to spend my time on is talking to MPs, talking to government about what needs to happen.
So, just before we finish, I mean, you're a social scientist in the Department of Criminology at Cambridge. I mean, how has it fallen out that, you know, I mean, I think it's magnificent that the university has kind of given you this post and given you the resource to do what you do. Was it a fight? Was it a struggle? I mean, I ran at Oxford College, I remember 10 years ago, trying to introduce computer science to the fellows. And there was a lot of pushback from some people, particularly in the humanities, saying, you know, computer science isn't a subject, you know, an academic subject. And they wouldn't say that now. But I can imagine that, you know, there would be some pushback in the university and in your college about what you're doing. Or that might have been, but I'm imagining less and less.
It's a good question. I would say there's pushback in the world more generally. I mean, I started studying conspiracy theories, you know, 15 years ago when nobody cared. I was, you know, why people think that there's aliens being hidden in the desert and stuff like that. I already got death threats from people 15 years ago for trying to engage with conspiracy theories. You know, I was being trolled by this guy who thinks that Shakespeare didn't write his own sonnets for years. I was, you know, Antichrist. I would get emails from people, you know, around the topic of vaccination. So I've developed a pretty thick skin over the years doing this. But what's different about the last few years is that, you know, academics, especially in the United States, are being harassed, threatened. They're trying to, you know, make it so that, you know, they can no longer have their jobs. I have several colleagues in the area of misinformation who, you know, the universities weren't in a position to keep supporting them due to, you know, lawsuits and fake claims about their scholarships. I mean, there's whole campaigns that are concocted to try to discredit fact checkers and journalism, scholars who work on misinformation, and that's a big apparatus, especially in the United States. And some of it is blowing over to the United Kingdom as well. But you know, I've been in a position. I feel that I've been lucky to be at the University of Cambridge in the sense that they've been extremely supportive of this work.
Look, it's been a fascinating hour. I mean, really, educative, illuminating, alerting us to great dangers. Also, inviting all of us to get into pre-bunking pretty quickly and inoculate ourselves partially to what's going on. Sander, thank you so much for giving it your time. Great, really good.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening.
The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.